Moisture issues can lead to all sorts of problems in the house, so what do we need to be on the lookout for, and what should we do if we discover a problem? Hi, John Munson here, in for Larry Mueller today. Larry is a bit under the weather. We wish him a speedy recovery. In the meantime, John Freiberger is back with us on the Ideas Network, and he's going to be talking about how to deal with moisture and fungal issues in houses. John is with Freiberger Construction Consulting and is a registered home inspector. He has 4 decades of experience in the restoration of old houses. So, do you have a moisture issue you'd like to ask about? And what general home improvement questions do you have? Why not give us a call at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post a question or a comment on our Facebook page. It's The Larry Mueller Show. And don't forget to like us when you're there. John, thanks for coming in today.
Glad to be here again.
So I know in the planning of this program, you used the phrase, the house of blue cheese. Why don't we start there?
Well, John, we have just had the wettest July we have ever had in Wisconsin, in at least recorded memory. And I've been spending an awful lot of time with a respirator and in a safety suit the last couple of months dealing with some of the issues that have been caused by the really heavy rainfalls that we've had around the state of Wisconsin. In some places, we've had as much as 14 inches in just a day or two. In the Madison area here, we've had 5, 6, and 7. So we have made things wet. And we know that if we have things wet, mold needs oxygen, there's plenty of that, and it needs food. If it has those three things, mold is going to grow, and we are seeing a lot of mold. So I thought that might be a good thing to discuss today, since we are still dealing with the damage that has been caused by this very wet weather.
Yeah, you know, that's okay. So mold needs oxygen and it needs food. I've seen mold grow on a bare concrete wall in an otherwise fairly dry basement. What does mold eat?
Well, mold will eat anything that is organic. Concrete itself is not organic. It's basically silicates and cements and clays that have been baked. But everything gets dirty. So we have right now the American Society of Heating, Refrigeration, and Air Conditioning is working on new standards for molds because this is becoming more and more of a problem as our climates change in the United States. Especially here in the Midwest, where we are supposed to be getting wetter while parts of the nation are supposed to be getting drier. And concrete is classified as a type 3, as a semi-resistant host to mold. But dirty concrete, and we have to think of the air in our house. I mean, we clean out our air filters, especially this time of year when we're starting up the furnaces, and there's some interesting stuff in there. Well, the stuff that's on the air filters is on our concrete walls. It's on stainless steel and it's on glass. So it's not necessarily the surface, but it's the food on the surface that is becoming moldy.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. But what about houses that have hot water baseboard heat?
How do you mean? Do you mean the...
Well, I mean, if there's no air exchanger, I mean, I can see in a forced air system where you've got air blowing around the house, you're going to be probably sending all sorts of organic material, skin cells and things we don't even want to talk about, that are going to be flying around your house. If you don't have anything that's, you know, basically circulating the air in the house, how does the dirt get on the walls?
Oh, our air is always circulating, John.
Okay.
Especially if you take a look at an older house where maybe they haven't painted or washed the walls for a little while, you'll notice little black plumes of dust up above the baseboards, up above the radiators, because we have air convection. We all know that heated air rises. So we have constant airflow that is going up the sides of our walls, coming up from around radiators. And then, of course, we have air leakage. We've talked about that a lot on programs. Our leaky old farmhouses, the ones that we haven't gone back and sealed, we'll have up to 13 air changes per hour. Hmm. I'd say the average house in Wisconsin is probably between 5 and 6 air changes per hour. So when the wind is blowing from the south, there's air moving from south to north across the interior of your house. So we are moving stuff on the air continuously in our houses, and we always will.
Okay. Well, that's good to know. So let's talk about some of the most common fungal issues that you see in houses.
Well, what we are seeing is fungal issues due to two things. First is just the plain old, we had a bad windstorm, the shingles blew off the roof and the water got down in the walls. So that is just plain wetting. Basically, we've had a problem with liquid water. And when we have a problem with liquid water and that liquid water sits for 48 hours or so, we are going to have some mold growth. It may not be visible, but the longer something stays wet from liquid water, the more moldy it's going to get. But what we get more commonly in Wisconsin is the majority of our mold growth is due to humidity. It is due to condensation, and it is also due simply to high relative surface humidity. Now, we've all been in our houses in the middle of winter, in the middle of January, and we look out at our windows, and we've got this layer of ice or water droplets around the outside of our window, especially down at the bottom. And if we don't dry that up, we come back and there's this gray matter there. Well, that's mold. And that is mold that is simply, there has been no leak, but water has condensed out and we've had mold growth. But we can get mold growth even when we don't have even when we don't have actual condensation. We can get it actually just from humidity.
And what sort of health effects do these mold issues have?
The mold can be more or less dangerous depending upon the type of the mold and depending upon the condition of the person. I think that one reason we're seeing a rise in things like childhood asthma and adult asthma is we know that people who live in old houses that have a tendency to get wet with poor insulation where there's a lot of condensation going on, that children who grew up in those houses have an elevated risk of asthma. And sometimes it's 300% the risk of asthma compared to a child that grows up in a much cleaner environment. There are also just plain mycotoxins, poisons, that come out of some molds. One of the nastiest molds is Strelibacha, which fortunately we don't see all that often. It's the famous black mold of the internet. But we do see that occasionally in houses in Wisconsin. Most of what we see indoors is either forms of Aspergillus or various penicillins. They do give off mycotoxins, but not to the extent of some of the really dangerous molds. But some people get sick from the mycotoxins, and other people will simply begin to develop allergies and asthmatic conditions. So it really behooves us to watch our human health by reducing our exposure to mold as much as we can. Now, there's mold everywhere. When we do an air test of a house, John, we always test the air on the outside the same day we're testing the inside. And we've actually had some houses where the outside was dirtier than the inside, which meant that they had a good filtration system. But then we'll often have houses where there's 200 particles of mold per whatever the cubic deciliters that we're testing, and we get inside and it's 20-some thousand. So literally hundreds of times more mold inside on a wet house. People exposed to that have a much greater risk of developing respiratory and allergic reactions.
Mm-hmm. So we talked a little bit about some of the causes of moisture in houses. Shingles blowing off, you can get water, liquid water, condensation on windows. What other ways do we end up with moisture problems in our homes?
We end up with lots of different sources of moisture in the house, and one of the really big ones is moisture that's coming up from the soil. If we have a house in Wisconsin that has a dirt crawl space, either under the entire house or a dirt basement, I still see a few of those, we are bringing in water vapor and probably also radon as well up from the soil. So we generally will find that basements have higher humidity than do other parts of the house. Now, of course, the basement is cooler, and the cooler the air, the higher the relative humidity is going to be. So anyone that is in a house that has uncontrolled, is completely open soil in their crawl spaces really needs to think about getting that taken care of. Now, moisture is also moving through concrete, especially through concrete block. And I don't necessarily mean, John, water running through the block, but block is porous. We do have water vapor coming into our house from the soil, unless we have a very modern house that has complete damp proofing, and those are few and far between. The other thing that we have is simply the humidity in the air. is we've had days this summer where we had outside humidity, well, in the evenings it was 100%, but during the middle of the day, 85, 83% relative humidity outside at 96 degrees was not unusual in Wisconsin. Now, we bring that air inside and it cools in the basement. Suddenly, we have very high moisture content in that air. We have very high relative humidity. The general rule is that if we have humidity above 85% in the ambient air, we are probably going to end up with visible mold growth someplace in that residence.
Mm-hmm. The that mold growth isn't always readily apparent. I mean, we might not know we have mold, and then all of it until it gets really bad, or we may not be looking for it. Does it always give off an odor? How do we find out if our houses are hiding something?
Well, the good news is that if we can't see it on an observable surface, even though it's there, it is probably not going to hurt us. One of the things that we are really looking at right now in research, and a great deal of research is ongoing, is that we are really beginning to focus on what is called visible mold. And there basically are seven standards for visible mold. One is no growth, some growth with a microscope, detected with a microscope over 10%, and then when you start getting to visible growth, and finally the worst possible stage is that piece of bread that's been sitting out for a long time and it's 100% covered with 100% covered with mold. So the testing that we're finding is that if you can't see it, you don't have to worry about it too much. Now, obviously, it's there, and if we keep things wet, it's going to grow. But it's when we can see the mold that we really need to start being concerned.
Mm-hmm. 800-642-1234, the number to call to join us on the Larry Mueller Show today. John Munson in for Larry. We're talking about moisture issues, fungal and moisture issues, and by fungal we mean mold. Mold and moisture issues in our houses with John Freiberger of Freiberger Construction Consulting in Fitchburg. He's a registered home inspector with four decades of experience in the analysis and restoration of old houses. If you have questions related to mold and moisture issues or old house questions in general, John is the guy to ask, and we have him here with us today on the Larry Mueller Show. Larry is a little under the weather today. John Munson in for Larry on the Ideas Network. We're going to take a short break, and then we are going to go to the phones. We have a lot of people with questions, John, and we'll get to those in just a moment. I'm John Munson. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Larry Mueller. Coming up later today on the Kathleen Dunn Show, asymmetrical politics and the divide of Democrats and Republicans. The political divide between Republican and Democratic voters could be much wider than previously understood. Kathleen's guest after 1 o'clock believes party supporters define the terms and stakes of political competition quite differently, which contributes to the disconnect. They'll talk about those differences. That's coming up later today on the Kathleen Dunn Show. This hour, we're talking about mold and moisture issues in your home with John Freiberger of Freiberger Construction Consulting in Fitchburg. John Munson in for Larry Mueller today on the Larry Mueller Show. 800-642-1234 is the number to call to join the program. You can also send an email, talk@WPR.org, or you can post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, and we'll take those questions for John Freiberger. Let's start with Heidi, who's calling us from Madison. Heidi, good morning. Thanks for joining us on the Larry Mueller Show today.
Good morning, John and John. I'm calling because I am renting a house, and it has an odor in it when you walk in the door. It smells kind of, I hate to say this, like an old person's house. And in the summer, it's worse. It kind of also has this kind of pungent smell. And I do know that the basement did have a mold problem that the owner remediated on his own. And a dehumidifier was put in the basement only last year, but this has been going on for a couple of years. So do you think it's mold, or what can be done to get rid of both the smell and to check to see if there might be a mold problem?
Okay, well, smells are always so complicated, aren't they? And we've dealt with some really interesting ones, again, due to the really high humidity. Well, the first thing to do, Heidi, is simply look for mold. Because as we said, if you can't see it, you don't have to worry about it too much. But if you go in the basement and you see things that looks like sort of white powder or a gray-blue powder, then we may have some mold. You may want to get a humidistat and just see what is the humidity in the basement. Now, if they've got a dehumidifier running, it should have a little LED display letting you know whether it's 40, 50, 60%. So check the dehumidification. Make sure that the basement is dry enough. If the basement is dry enough, I'm assuming this is a house that has some air conditioning.
Air, and I do know that I think about 4 or 5 years ago, insulation was blown into all of the walls, so it's quite energy efficient.
It is, okay.
Yeah.
Good. And how old is the house, Heidi?
You know, I don't know for sure, but I think it's 40s, 50s. It's on the near west side of Madison.
Okay, great. Fortunately, a house from the 40s and 50s is mostly made up of type 2 and type 3 materials, which means it has real wood in it, not what we call wuzzwood. It doesn't have chipped up sapwood and things like that. So the house that you're living in has a better resistance to mold than if you were living in a brand new house that has a lot of products that are one step removed from paper. So it's possible you have some mold, but you need to think about a couple of other things. We ran into a really interesting house in Cross Plains where they changed how the house dried and they made the walls wetter. And all of a sudden, they had terrible odors. I believe we've determined that this was cat spray from years ago, that as things became wetter, basically the smells came back. So you may have to do a little bit of searching, of looking for stains and those sorts of things. And what you're probably going to find in the winter, it's going to be gone. And if we have a wet summer again next year, if you don't have things well humidified, it may come back. So do a visual inspection first. If you don't find anything, see if it fades away. It may be some sort of volatile chemical that's coming off of something other than mold, or it could be mold. But observation is where we have to start.
Heidi, thanks so much for the call. It seems to me that just about every house has a unique odor to it. When you open the front door, you always catch something, don't you?
Yes, one tends to. A new house with formaldehyde or an old house with heavens knows what.
And sometimes, I don't know, a dusty old wood has its own, there's a what I used to call attic odor. You get that particularly, and you notice it more when it's hot than in the wintertime.
Right, because we do have heat will cause volatile organic compounds to move out of wood and out of other materials as well. So in very, very hot weather, you will certainly get more smells. So both heat will elevate smells in-house and as will humidity.
Let's take another call. Heidi, thanks for the call. Good luck with that. The odors in your rental there. Wayne is with us next in Lisbon. Wayne, hello.
Hi. Well, I'm glad you gave Heidi some ideas and explained old person's house smell. I thought that was kind of it was a little odd to describe it that way. Anyway. What I wanted to talk about was moisture on the inside of windows. What I have is a house that was built in 97, so it's, relatively new. I've got casement windows, and the house is, I think, very well insulated. We don't have a problem really with that. But in the dead of winter, on the coldest nights, it seems like we get ice on our windows. And
ice on the inside of the windows?
On the inside of the windows, yes.
Right. What's happening there, Wayne, is basically these windows, even if they're really, really good windows, I mean, your ceilings in your house are probably R40, R44, even R50, your walls are maybe in the R20s. Your windows, if they're some of the best made, are R5. So your windows are going to be much colder than any other surface that is between you and the outside weather. So we have this thing called dew point, is we know when we cool air, we end up getting the water vapor dropping out of it because the relative humidity as the air cools rises till it hits 100%. So what is happening is the water activity, as we call it, which is also called surface relative humidity, has reached 100% on your window simply because they're a cold surface. They're what's called in the trade the first condensing surface. That is, it's where the water is going to condense when it hits the dew point, and because it's cold, it does hit the dew point. So this really is pretty normal. The lower you have your general ambient relative humidity in the house, the lower your surface water activity level is going to be, or your relative humidity at the surface. So if your house last winter was in the 50s, maybe try to get it down into the 40s this winter. But you're still going to find in Wisconsin, when it is 0 degrees outside, even quite a dry house, even with quite good windows, is going to get some condensation. But start monitoring your house this winter, you know, by Humidistat, and see how wet your house is or isn't. And if your house is wet, then you're going to need to think about what you're going to do about that. Do you need to add some sort of mechanical ventilation, like an air-to-air heat exchanger, to get the winter humidity a bit lower? So do a little bit of science, do a little bit of measurement, see what you have, determine if you have a problem. And if you have a problem, there's usually an easy solution. And nowadays, it tends to be a mechanical solution.
Wayne, good luck with the ice on your windows. Thanks for calling. 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. John Freiberger is with us. We're talking about mold and moisture problems in your home. And we have Pete from Reedsburg next. Pete, hello.
Hi, John. Thanks much. My question concerns insulation, specifically the advisability of insulating sidewalls in an old house and moisture problems that could happen because of that. I have a wood frame Cape Cod house built in 1942. I've got pretty good insulation in the attic. Not great. I think it can be improved, but pretty good. But I have reason to believe there's nothing in the sidewalls. And the conventional wisdom is that, you know, I should take advantage of the spray foam technology we have today to insulate those sidewalls, and because more insulation is better. But I see online various experts or people who are alleging to be experts, contractor types, saying that insulating the sidewalls of an old house can be a really bad idea because it can lead to moisture and rot. And I'm wondering how Mr. Freiberger sees that issue.
Okay. Well, I see it sort of the way the Department of Interior does. If you had a historic house, Pete, and you're on the National Register and you wanted to add insulation, the Department of Interior would tell you no, not unless you add a vapor barrier on the inside of your house. Because what we have found in old houses, especially houses much older than yours, like the old balloon-framed ones, remember we were talking to Wayne about a first condensing surface, which in Wayne's case was his window? What can happen is when you cool off that interstitial space, that space between your plaster and the outside sheathing, when you cool that off, the first condensing surface ends up being the backside of the sheathing. So you're going to have some moisture because you've got air leaks into that wall. And what's going to happen is you're going to have moisture condensing out on the backside of the sheathing inside your wall. Now, that can cause some mold issues, but it can also cause things like the corrosion of fasteners. So we have old balloon frame houses that have become structurally untenable because the nails have rusted off because somebody blew in insulation in the walls. But you mentioned spray foam. If you use a closed cell spray foam, you are adding a vapor barrier at the same time you're adding an air barrier and the thermal insulation. You are getting three barriers for one. So if you're thinking of trying to get like a closed cell two-part urethane spray in there, that's a very good idea because you are solving three problems at once, and it may have a very significant change on how air, moisture, and heat escape and come into your house.
Pete, does that answer your question?
I think so. So it sounds like you're a fan of the spray foam.
I'm very much a fan of the spray foam. I know that there's some criticism from environmental, you know, is it a green product or is it not a green product? My feeling is you've got a 1940s house with a lot of embedded energy and a lot of value to it. even if you use a product that is petrochemical based, it isn't completely green, and you preserve that house for another 100 years and don't burn up a lot of natural gas or fuel oil in the next 100 years, I really think you're practicing green architecture, even though some people will say, oh, that stuff is awful. It's, you know, comes out of oil barrels. So I really think you have to look at preserving your house, preserving the environment, utilizing fewer utilities, and making your house just safer and more habitable health-wise as well.
Pete, thanks so much for the call. 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. We have an email from Ben who writes, could you talk a bit about furnace filters? What is MERV, M-E-R-V, and is a 16 MERV the same as 2 8 MERV filters, or are 2 MERV just, or are 2 MERV 8s equal to 1 8? I think I read that right. If my filter space, I mean, I didn't know there was going to be math. This starts to look like a story problem, the kind I used to have nightmares about in the fourth grade. If my filter space is 4 inches deep, can I use 2 2-inch filters of appropriate MERV ratings? And is MERV a measure of airflow or air resistance? Well, a lot of questions there from Ben. John, I hope you have some answers, because when it comes to MERV.
I've got a few answers. Basically, what we're using filters for is to get particles out of the air. And the best filters out there, of course, are the HEPA filters, which basically will take out just about everything. The MERVs are rated from a MERV 5 up to a MERV 16, I believe. Now, maybe that's changed. And the higher the number, the more they're going to take out. Like a MERV 16 is about 96% as good as a HEPA filter. The problem is a lot of furnace fans aren't strong enough to use a HEPA filter. The question about can you add 2 MERV 8s together, I don't think that 2 8s equal a 16 because of the size of the air spaces between the filter materials. But again, that is a spot where I'm not entirely sure.
What does MERV stand for?
Oh, I know, and it's one of these things that we use all the time, and I can't remember exactly what it stands for.
You know what?
For.
I'll Google it at the next
it,
break.
Yeah.
We'll come back to that. So two eights don't really equal a 16 because the rating is based on the space, the size basically of the sieve, I guess you could say.
That is correct.
All filters are sieves.
It's minimum efficiency reporting value. Reporting is the word I couldn't come up with. Minimum efficient reporting value. So in other words, a MERV is something that's actually been tested, and the results, as far as the percentages of particles removed from the air, actually has been reported. So in other words, it's like almost like saying a UL-tested or, you know, Warnock-Hershey-tested filter.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, it's something that's been certified to actually work. Because when we're using these things in commercial applications, we're having to follow the ASHRAE standards. The ASHRAE standards will specify the type of filtration that we need. You think about hospitals and clean rooms and labs and those sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
As far as the size of the filters, I can't remember whether something's going to fit in 4 inches or not, but we do see a lot of furnaces where you've only got place for that little hardware store sort of 1-inch thick filter, and those really don't clean the air. They pick up the really big stuff like the cat hair and keep it from ending up in the heat exchanger, but they do nothing to clean our air. But almost any HVAC contractor is going to be able to revise that return plenum so you can put in the filter of your choice. And a lot of them are made here in Wisconsin, the Space Guard, the April Air, the pleated sorts of filters. I'd have to check on the ratings of them. But we have a lot of good filtration products here, made here in Wisconsin, that we can use on Wisconsin heating equipment.
Well, you mentioned that a lot of furnaces can't handle HEPA filters. What can we do in that case if HEPA is the kind of filtering we really want?
Well, if a MERV 16 or a MERV 14 will work, a MERV 14 is going to remove approximately 80% of the particles that a HEPA filter will get. If it'll work with a 14, by the time you get on to MERV 12, you're down to about 50% filtration. But even that is so much better than what we usually see as a filter. And, of course, how often are you running your fan? Our new fans that have modulating flame and modulating fans, we're telling a lot of people to keep those fans running all the time. So you could run a HEPA filter for 3 hours a day, or you could run a 12 for 24 hours a day, and your air is going to be cleaner with the 12 than it is with the HEPA because you're filtering a larger volume of air.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that was, we all learned something there, I think.
Sorry, that was a little technical, but...
Well, that's okay. You know, that's actually what it called for. It's a very technical question. And that's the audience for Wisconsin Public Radio.
It is a smart audience.
We're really technical. Here's maybe a little simpler problem from Justin, who writes to ask, can you walk me through how to repair a leak around a roof vent pipe?
A roof vent pipe. Well, we don't know what type of pipe this is. If it's a sewer vent pipe, the usual type, if it's a metal flashing, it's probably an F.E. Moore flashing. These are a type of flashing that have four little, what do you call them, little like folds in them. And mm-hmm. the roofer is supposed to sort of unfold this so that the flashing top, where the pipe comes through, drains downhill. About 50% of the ones we see, they're draining backwards. So what you basically do is you go up and take the four nails out, you bend it out further, and you re-nail it and put a little roof cement along the side. If it's one of the newer rubber boots, EPDM boots, then you're going to have to do a little bit of checking to see why exactly it's leaking. If it's a low-pitch roof, maybe something's backing up. So I'm afraid I can't go much further on that one, but I mm-hmm. do know a lot of the F.E. Moore vents are installed incorrectly by the roofers. And if you look at it from the ground, if it's pitched the opposite direction of the pitch of the roof, you know it's wrong.
Okay.
And so don't fall off the roof.
Yeah, please don't fall off the roof. Good idea. Let's go back to the phones, and we'll go to Duluth, Minnesota, and talk to Pat. Pat, hello. Welcome to the Larry Mueller Show.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. About 5 years ago, we had an air exchanger put in our house by a very good company, and the first year, the air quality was like walking into a pristine forest. It was just astonishing, and the condensation on the windows gone. But since then, I'd say for 2 years it was okay, but now the air quality is really not good. I'm back to putting cloves and cinnamon on the stove, and we had one of the men come out last month, and he measured the air going out, and it was the same as when they installed it, so that was good. And then he measured air coming in, and he said that was lower. He couldn't explain why that was lower, and he had used two different types of instruments to measure that airflow. And so we just left it at he couldn't explain why it would be less air coming into the house. I'm almost ready to give up on it. It's been 2 years now that it's really not been up to those first-year standards. But I'm just wondering if there's anything you might have on the top of your head that could explain this.
Oh, Pat, you do have the filters changed and cleaned annually?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's possible. We do find HRVs, heat recovery ventilation systems, where we do get core failure. And it could be that you're simply ending up with core failure. You can, of course, replace the core without replacing, the fans and the box and everything else. So I think you maybe want to have your HVAC guy come back and really take a look at the core and see if he can figure out if we do have some problems with it, especially some of the older ones that almost had, I don't want to use the word paper, but sort of like a cellulose-based core. We have seen some failures in those. The warranties on them are usually relatively short, but get the model number, go online, look to see if there's been a recall on them. You might find that they were recalled and you're entitled to a brand new free core for your HRV. So do a little bit of online research first. The model numbers and everything should be on a tag on the side because that's required by U.S. law. Google that. Also, go to the company. If it's Mitsubishi, go to Mitsubishi and go to tech support and say, here's the problem we're having. Many of these companies are very, very good about trying to help you out.
Beth, thanks so much for that call. Let's go to Rice Lake next. And Roy is with us. Roy, welcome to the Larry Mueller Show.
Hi, thank you. My question is, I have visible mold in my basement, and when it rains, it rains inside. My house is older; it's from the '40s, and with my family's financial situation right now, I just cannot see in any foreseeable future of getting this help. Does your guest know of any financial help that I could get to take care of mold, anything like that?
Roy, I'm afraid I don't. Just because your basement leaks doesn't mean you have mold. I have an 1850s stone foundation. When it rains, it leaks. And I simply don't have anything down there that can get moldy, and I keep a dehumidifier on all summer so that I dry up the water quickly. So what I would suggest you do is first, what type of foundation? Is it a concrete block foundation? Is it poured concrete? What sort of foundation do you have in the house?
Yes, we have it is a block foundation, and I took my hammer drill and popped into a couple of them in between the webbings, and it was coming right out of there, so
sure.
The water is definitely there.
Certainly. It's going into the wall in various little cracks because a concrete masonry unit, we call them CMU for shorthand, always leak. So you're getting the water out at the bottom, which is good, so you don't get as much vapor pressure pushing it. You know, I would take a pressure washer, and I think I would wash your basement walls. I'd wash the floor, and I'd get a good dehumidifier. I'm hoping you don't have anything visible on the framing of your house. You don't have anything that looks like white powder or blue powder. And if you don't, then you've pretty well taken care of it. If you do have some white or blue powder, that then is going to worry me a little bit. Certainly, you know, check with your local units of government to see if there are any assistance programs up in the Rice Lake area. If there is actual mold pollution and you need to take care of it, perhaps there is something that is out there and is available. But we talked earlier about the various types of materials, and that concrete really is not a host of mold. It's the dirt on the concrete. So if you pressure wash that basement, get the dirt off the wall, you should not really have mold on the wall. Generally, we need liquid water for about 48 hours before we get any mold growth at all. And as I said, we need about 85% surface humidity, or what's called a 0.8 water activity at the surface, to get mold growth. But as we said earlier also, we need food. So if you get rid of the food, you can live with the water and the oxygen in the basement. You won't have that much of a mold issue. Does that make sense to you, Roy?
Yeah, that makes sense. I keep two dehumidifiers running down there. I turn a fan on when it gets really bad, if there's standing water.
Mm-hmm.
Try to keep the air moving.
Right.
And I try to change my furnace filter as often as possible. And I keep a couple of house filters going on, you know, during the winter months. So.
And be religious about keeping those gutters clean. Make sure your downspouts are extended.
Yeah.
If you can add a little soil around the house so that you've got a positive pitch, which is defined as a half inch per foot, anything you can do to lower the groundwater. I know sometimes, though, we're in flat neighborhoods or in the bottom of a hill, and we are going to get wet basements, just like my house.
A lot of clay up in the Rice Lake area, too. It's not quite up to sand country up. It's not quite far north enough to be sand country up there.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty heavy soil, I think. Roy, thanks so much for calling. We're going to take a short break, and we'll come back and have more with John Freiberger. We're talking about fungal and moisture issues and all sorts of other house and home improvement issues. This morning on the Larry Mueller Show, John Munson in for Larry today. John Freiberger is with Freiberger Construction Consulting of Fitchburg and is a registered home inspector with 4 decades experience in the analysis and restoration of old houses. John Munson in for Larry Mueller, and we'll be back in just a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Moisture issues can lead to all sorts of problems in the house, and that's what we're talking about today on the Larry Mueller Show. John Munson in for Larry today. John Freiberger is back with us. We've been talking about how to deal with moisture and mold in houses. 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Talk at WPR.org is the email address. You can also post to the Joy Cardine Show, to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. I knew I was going to do that once today. You can post to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, and that's another way to get in touch. Let's go to the phones. We'll go to Joan in Monona. Joan, hello.
Hi there. Yeah. John, I have a question. My house was built in the 50s. Two of the rooms are mostly underground. Back in the old days, I definitely got mold. Then had a Santa Fe dehumidifier installed and run that in the summertime and do not have a mold problem. I'm wondering if I should run it in the winter. I did have it on for a while, and there seemed to be no liquid coming out of the hose, so I've turned it off now for some time. Should you run your dehumidifier? It's a big one. You know, the Santa Fe dehumidifier is big. Should you run those in the wintertime? And if you should, and you have a humidistat, what percent of humidity should you use to get that running?
The last part there, Joan, is the answer to the question is we want to keep that humidity controlled. I generally set mine at about 45%. And since the dehumidifier you're using should have a humidistat in it, it simply isn't going to run if you're down at 40 or 38%. Now, in the winter, do you have forced air heat or you have a hot water heat or a boiler?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. So you don't have quite as much air circulation as if you had forced air heat. So you do need to perhaps even out the humidity in the house. The house is going to be subjected to drying conditions in the winter because our outside air is so dry. You have a 1950s house, so it's probably relatively leaky. Even if it doesn't feel like it, it may be somewhat leaky. So I would just go ahead and set that Santa Fe at 45%. When it's really, really cold, and if you don't like the moisture on the windows, you could go down to 40%. If you get below that, it starts getting a little bit uncomfortable. So I would experiment with what feels comfortable to you, keep it at that, and that should keep at bay any significant mold growth.
Joan, thanks for the call. You know, the dehumidifiers that you buy today, a lot of them have a setting called basement. Is sort of an automatic thing, I guess. Is that something you should do, or should you actually target a specific humidity level?
I tend to target a humidity level because then it's giving you some sort of feedback. Because usually, if you have a humidity level, you can actually find out what the existing humidity is. So you can at least. If it's just set on basement or constant run or something, you don't really know what you're doing. But if you can check the humidity level, that is giving you a little bit of information.
Okay. Joan, thanks so much for the call. Mike is in Reading, Michigan. Mike, hello.
Yes, hi. Calling about an old house that I bought recently. I'm going to be renovating the whole thing. It's a two-story and about 25 by 25 square. Got a large attic space. Now, it's got old siding that leaks a lot of air, and eventually I'm planning on pulling out the plaster on the inside walls so that I can re-electrify and plumb and everything. And so I'm looking to find out whether or not I should go with the foam insulation or the fiberglass. I plan to do foam in the ceiling, but in the walls I thought maybe I should go with the regular, something like fiberglass because I was concerned about moisture. One of the odd things about it, I tell people when the outside winds are at 20 to 30 miles an hour, I have inside winds 2 to 3 miles an hour because the siding is so, has a lot of gaps. So I'm filling those in, and I'm going to paint it eventually. But I'm just a little concerned about doing the foam because I thought I've been hearing or reading some things that, if I enclose myself within this foam jacket, it's going to be, a problem eventually.
Mike, when you say old, how old is this house?
Oh, it's 130 years old, maybe more. Yeah, probably built in 1885. And one thing that I'm planning to do when I actually pull the plaster out of it is I'm going to make create a bit of sheathing. In between the studs, I'm going to put some thin OSB to create an outside sheathing.
John Freiberger, what about Mike's old house?
Now, Mike, is this a house that has no exterior sheathing and you have a lap siding directly over the studs?
Correct.
Wow. Yikes. So this is an old balloon frame house and it's extremely lightweight. Now, you don't have interior sheathing, do you?
No.
Okay, so you basically have no sheathing. And you have nails that are 130 years old and have been rusting for years and years and years. I think that I would attack this project from the exterior. I'm really worried about structural stability for this this house. And I don't know how on the interior. Now, I suppose you could put oriented strand board across the entire wall surface. I mean, you're not talking about putting it in the space between the studs, are you?
Yeah, I'm talking about in between the space, you know, between the studs.
Yeah, that's not going to work.
No, it's not going to work.
We really need to produce what's called a shear wall. We'd need to use 4x8 sheets. What I would suggest you do is attack this from the exterior. Your siding almost certainly has lead on it, so you know you're going to have to either have a lead certified contract, or if you do it yourself, you're going to have to capture the lead with plastic and wear the right respirators. So read up on that. But I think what I would do is I would very gingerly, and not the whole house at once, is take off a section. Then I don't care what you insulate it with. Maybe the thing to do is to go ahead and put in fiberglass. Now, fiberglass is not nearly as efficient as two-part foam as far as the R factor per inch, nor does it provide the wind barrier. But there's other ways for less money that I think we can do that. So one way would be to take off the exterior, do the spray foam, put on a well-nailed sheathing, put on water and wind barrier, and put new siding on. If you go with wood siding, you want to use a rain screen system. If it's a vinyl siding, it doesn't make too much difference, but you need the weather barrier. The other way of doing it, which might be less expensive, would be to take it off on the exterior, put in the fiberglass, and then add the sheathing, and then put a couple of inches of foam over the top of the sheathing so that the inside of your wall is still warm. What you have to do, we talked a couple of times about first condensing surfaces. We have to make the inside of that wall warm enough that you don't get condensation in it. So there's two ways. There are at least those two ways of looking at it. My preference would be to simply foam the whole thing, then to go ahead and put on the exterior sheathing. And I would still then put an inch of foam on the exterior to get rid of the thermal bridging, along with your wind and water barrier, and then your siding. And you should have something that is as modern as a new home. Now, you mentioned earlier, people were warning you that you didn't want to be sitting inside a foam cooler. Well, actually, you do. It's just that your house right now probably leaks like a sieve. If we tried to pressurize it to 50 pascals to get a measurement, we probably couldn't even get there. Because like you said, you can't keep a candle lit when the wind is blowing. So once you stop all of this air movement, you may have to add a heat recovery ventilation system. But your utility bills are going to plummet to such an extent, and the house is going to be so much more comfortable, that that may be a wise investment. And basically what you're going to be doing, Mike, is you're going to take a 130-year-old house and you're going to make it perform just about as well as a new house. In fact, probably better than most of the new houses built today. So do a little bit more research. You can get a lot of good stuff from Building Science Corporation in Cambridge, Massachusetts. My friend Joe Stilbeck writes program after program, article after article. There's a lot of books available. Do some research. Cost out a couple of different alternatives and go from there. Does that help?
Yes, indeed. I had planned to maybe put off the the exterior siding to another later date. That's why I thought about doing what I was thinking about doing. You know, but that could be just what I have to do to begin with. So
it could well be. I'm really concerned. The other thing, what is probably holding your house together is the wood lath on the wall.
All right, Mike, good luck. Good luck with that 1885 house. Wow, that is an old house. Here's one of our listeners wrote to let us know about a vapor barrier for older houses that it's painted on, called Super Spec by Benjamin Moore. Helene writes that I've used it. It's water-based. HUD house rehabs require this, according to Helene. Just follow the instructions for the paint coat thickness and do both coats. What do you know about Super Spec, John?
I've used various ones from Insulade, from Glidden. I know was federally certified. So there are definitely paints, and many old houses have a lot of paint, and the plaster or the old drywall really isn't vapor permeable. The problem we run into is we have all these holes. Every light switch, every outlet, the TV jack, the spot where the plaster doesn't quite meet the floor in back of the baseboard, around the casings, around the windows, all these spots leak as well. So certainly with the movement of vapor through the plaster or drywall, the paint will take care of that, but that does not necessarily air seal our house. So the government allows it because it's certainly better than nothing, but I think that what you really want to do, I've forgotten the name of John of our listener who emailed in, but I think what Elaine should start with is she should see how much air leakage her house has, so she should go ahead and get an energy inspection.
Well, she was actually just recommending it to as something that she had used that had worked.
Okay. Well, let's say that if anyone is thinking of using this, they need some science and testing first, so they should start out with the blower door test to see what their air leakage is. If they don't have much air leakage, then this is going to work. If they have a lot of air leakage, it's not going to work.
All right. Well, we need to step aside for the news from National Public Radio here on the Larry Mueller Show. And then John Freiberger stays with us until 12:30 today to answer your questions about old houses and moisture problems and mold. We've got quite a few emails and a lot of phone calls. We'll try to get to as many as we can between now and 12:30. John Freiberger of Freiberger Construction Consulting of Fitchburg, a regular guest on the Larry Mueller Show. By the way, John will be back on December 8th. Hopefully, Larry will be back tomorrow. John Munson in for Larry Mueller on the Larry Mueller Show. You're listening to this program on the Ideas Network of WPR. Glad to have you with us on the Ideas Network. John Munson in for Larry Mueller. And today we're talking about home improvement with Larry Mueller Show regular John Freiberger. John is with Freiberger Construction Consulting, a registered home inspector with four decades of experience in the restoration of old houses. We've been talking about moisture issues, but John also is also here to answer other home improvement questions. So join the conversation at 800-642-1234, talk at WPR.org, or on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Well, John, one of the things that you mentioned earlier in connection with moisture problems in houses was crawl spaces. We have two emails and a phone call about that. So I want to kind of combine all of these into one discussion about crawl spaces. We have an email from Steve who just wants to know what to do. Part of our basement has a dirt crawl space. Should we fill that area with concrete? The house is about 20 years old. That's Steve's question. Okay, here's another one a little bit more involved from Conrad, who writes, talk about a timely topic. Your show began as I was standing in the crawl space of our kitchen. I say standing because I have removed the kitchen floor in order to remediate the crawl space. This is necessary because there are moisture problems, including aged plumbing and bare dirt. I'm digging out the crawl space about 6 to 10 inches so it will be humanly possible to work on the plumbing. Where do you stand on what seems to be an unsettled debate, that is, to vent or to seal and dehumidify the crawl space? I am probably going to have to go the vent route with 6 mil plastic and some gravel. Can you talk a little bit about the do's and don'ts of doing that? So why don't we tackle those, and then I've got a phone call from somebody who also has crawl space issues.
Certainly. We'll take Steve and Conrad here. First, if we have dirt crawl space, we want to seal that crawl space. The easiest way to seal it is, there are special fabrics now made for crawl spaces, and they're usually heavy white fabrics. They have some fiber in them so that if you crawl through them, you're not going to tear them. Some people in the past have used like 4 mil and 6 mil plastic visqueen, you know, the clear plastic stuff uses drop claws. Problem is, you crawl around in there, you're going to break it. So the best way of doing it is, I would suggest putting down some fan fold insulation, which is that insulation, it comes folded up, becomes four times the size when it's unfolded, it's a half inch thick. You can lay that down first, gives you a little bit of insulation, you loose lay it, and then you go over the top of that with a good heavy plastic or the special crawl space encapsulation fabric. You have to be very careful that you seal it. Every place there's a penetration, including sealing it to the outside walls. Basically, we want no radon, no water vapor, or any other soil gas to be able to come up through that. The reason is we don't want to breathe the radon, second leading cause of lung cancer in the U.S., and we don't want all of this moisture that is going to cause mold. Now, as far as venting, I need to go with what the Uniform Dwelling Code says. The Uniform Dwelling Code says that all crawl spaces must be vented into the rest of the house. And I think that really does make sense. We do want to have some air change and not just have dead air. We're going to have some sort of access. And remember, we're going to have some air movement no matter what. So I think that venting it to the rest of the house, the dehumidifier can be in the crawl space, but often there isn't enough room. So then we can put it in the basement itself. I've even seen people who've put little vent fans in the crawl space and will turn them on occasionally just to change the air in it. Does that cover everything from Steve and Conrad then, John?
I think and Conrad's question was just kind of a general, I've got this crawl space now, what do I do? And I think you covered that as well. So.
Right. At least seal it. If you can insulate it and seal it, that's even better, because that is going to get us, I think, to David's question from Eau Claire, isn't it? Because
yeah.
David has sealed his crawl space, and now he's got moisture on top of the plastic.
Well, let's hear from David and from his own lips.
All
David,
right.
In Eau Claire, you're next. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. Yes, my crawl space, after it was covered with plastic, the hot water heater on the main floor leaked onto it for some time. So there's moisture on top of the plastic. So my question is, where do I go from here? If I poke holes in the plastic, that kind of defeats the purpose.
Well, how high is the crawl space that you're dealing with there, David?
It's real shallow. I have to crawl. I mean, it's maybe 18 inches.
Okay.
Deep.
Well, as I mentioned, a couple people have actually put like little bathroom exhaust fans for their crawl space to move air. So can't we rig up some sort of fan along one wall that just blows some air into that crawl space? Now, is this a crawl space attached to a basement, David, where you can put a dehumidifier, or is the entire house crawl space?
There's a very small basement area, and there's a concrete wall between that and the crawl space.
So, there's no hole in that wall at all?
Well, there's a slight hole that was put there because there was some problem with frozen pipes a couple of years ago.
Right. Okay. So, all right. Well, I think what we have to dry this out. The only way you're going to dry it out is by putting in dry air. So perhaps you can rig up some sort of box fan that can blow in there, but it'd be nice to have a second opening. And then we can dehumidify that basement air so that maybe we're blowing 45% relative humidity air in there, and we eventually simply dry that up under there. There is. How old is your house, Dave?
It was built in the 60s.
In the 60s. Okay, so it probably has a certain amount of air leakage at the ring joists, unless you've actually put foam on those.
There's foam on the outside. There's foam in the crawl space, and they covered up the. It actually had vent holes. It had two vent holes on each side of the house, and they covered them up saying they weren't necessary.
Well, they were necessary, but of course, if you had frozen pipes, it meant those vent holes were bringing in below zero air up in Eau Claire in the winter. Well, difficult situation. We need to get dry air in there. Perhaps one thing you can do very carefully, if you can, is open those vent holes a little bit for the next couple of weeks to try to get some dry air through there to dry up that moisture that's sitting in there, and then close the vent holes again. Or you can try to introduce drier basement air and dehumidify the air that is coming out. You will get some air leakage no matter what during the winter, so it's probably going to dry up naturally during the winter. But I'm a little concerned that if you've got relative humidity in that crawl space above 85%, that you could get mold forming on your joists and on your floor sheathing. So that's why I think we should try to control this sooner rather than later.
David, good luck with that. And we have yet another email about crawl spaces. This one a little bit different. From up in Burnett County, Eric writes, some historic rainfall amounts in the Burnett County area this summer has left our vacation home 50 feet from the lake with water in the crawl space. The level of the water is exactly the level of the lake with almost pure sand soil. Trying to pump out the water is fruitless. We filled the crawl space in by hand with washed sand to a point now the floor is mostly wet sand with less freestanding water. We hope the lake level goes down. If not, we may move our cabin back next year, worried about mold and about block foundation breaking with freezing. What are your thoughts?
Worth worrying about. Though there are alternatives to moving the cabin. One is simply to pick up the cabin and pour a floating slab with frost walls underneath it that is completely waterproofed. I can design a foundation that he could put in the middle of his lake and it would keep the basement dry. So there are alternatives, but he has a very difficult problem. For now, he has that wet sand in there, so let's at least for the winter, until he does something else or the lake level drops, let's introduce some plastic sheeting in there, try to vent that crawl space as best we can. I don't know whether this is a seasonal cabin and it's winterized or not. If it's winterized, it could be vented to the exterior. If it's not winterized, then maybe we're going to have to try to do some dehumidification as we talked about with our earlier callers. But at least let's go ahead and get some plastic down there to reduce the amount of water vapor that's coming out to try to keep that relative humidity in the crawl space below 85%.
All right, and good luck. It says vacation home, so we don't know about that.
Right.
We had an email here about dehumidifiers, and the salient point is that they work best at certain temperatures, and the average portable dehumidifier doesn't really work well below 60 degrees. Can you shed a little light on this, please?
Well, yeah, that is true. The temperature does make a difference. I mean, there's a point where they simply don't work when you get down near freezing. I don't know the specifics of all the dehumidifiers, and it's constantly changing, so I think I would probably do a little bit of search on the various models that are available. The Sierras, the Santa Fe's, the ones that are made here in Wisconsin, I would take a look at first because they're more likely to have been made for our climate than something that is made in Georgia or North Carolina.
Mm-hmm. One place where just about everybody seems to have a moisture problem is the bathroom. Of course, we've got the shower. There's a lot of water in there. And we've had several emails with questions about that. Here's one from Anna who says she has a 1937 Cape Cod that recently had a bathroom renovation before she purchased it. And despite the recent changes, it seems that the ventilation is still poor. Condensation forms on the windows and mirror even after a short shower. And the humidity is still evident after 15 to 20 minutes of running the fan afterwards, and it seems there is already some discoloration on the ceiling that concerns this emailer about mold, and she's wondering what she can do about it.
Okay, that is really a very, very typical problem, John. We will see a lot of the exhaust fans now have timers on them. Some are the old turn to a certain point timer. You can now get timers that have humidistats on them. They also have some nice little push-button ones with LEDs. You can do 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 20 minutes. But the first thing we need to check is there actually any air going through that exhaust fan. We found exhaust fans that where the motor ran but no air moved. So you can do the paper towel test and see if there actually is air moving through it. Secondly, is it vented to the exterior? Because we have to make sure this thing is vented outside and is not just moving this overly wet air into the attic or some other part of the house. The next thing to look at is simply go with a better quality fan. If it's possible, you can put remote fans in the attic. Remote fans will move 200, 250, 300 cubic feet per minute, where a lot of the inexpensive exhaust fans are the 60 to 90 to 120. So you can double the amount of air movement. I would expect this is a fairly small bathroom. The smaller the bathroom, the lower the volume of air. So the water vapor makes the air wetter than it would in a large bathroom. So I think taking a look at the amount of air change you can get into this room, either by a better exhaust fan where one is currently located with good ducting, or a good quality remote fan, and perhaps the use of a timer are the things that will probably cure the issues here.
Mm-hmm. We have a couple of more bathroom questions as well. Here's an email that says, we have a mold mildew issue in our bathroom, especially in the shower. The only thing that seems to keep it at bay is a bleach-based cleaner. My partner insists on banning bleach, however, claiming that it kills off the good bacteria that keeps the pipes clear. So what's the solution, bleach or no bleach?
No bleach. We just have too many volatile compounds coming out of bleach that can cause lung damage. Years and years and years ago, bleach was the cure for everything that had to do with mold. It really isn't anymore. Again, we need to same advice we've just given to Ann is we need to get the humidity down in this bathroom so that we don't have the mold issues. Mm-hmm. If we have, depending upon the type of, this is an acrylic, a fiberglass, or a tile shower surround, we have the little squeegee, sort of like window cleaner things. Sometimes we need to wipe the walls down after we're done showering so that water goes down the drain rather than evaporate. But let's do everything we possibly can to reduce the humidity in that bathroom, reduce the mold that way, rather than possibly harm ourselves by breathing the fumes off of a cleaner that we really don't want to use.
Okay. Thanks for that question and email. Let's take a call next from Marcy, who has a bathroom issue, and Marcy's calling us from Fort Atkinson. Marcy, welcome to the Larry Mueller Show.
Well, thank you for taking my call. I hope I can make this question understandable. We had a problem in the bathroom ceiling leaking. We think we've got it corrected, but we don't know if there's insulation up there that needs to be removed after the leaking problem. There's a flat roof up above, and there's no way to get into the ceiling except through the vent, which we can't seem to get down. But if you think that there's insulation up there that we should remove, I guess we'll have to work at that. What do you think? It's a 100-year-old house.
And, Marcy, do we have any idea what type of insulation is up in the ceiling?
I don't know if there's insulation.
Oh, there may be none. Okay. Well, I'm going to suggest you call a local Fort Atkinson home inspector, and you want to talk to one that has a Delmhurst or other moisture meter that has the 8-inch long probes on them. What they will do is they'll have a little punching tool. They'll make two little pinholes or nail holes in your ceiling. They will insert this probe up there, and they will be able to measure the moisture in the insulation up there. You're going to have a little bit of paint repair to do, but you can't do this completely non-intrusively, but this is minimal intrusion. So go to the American Society of Home Inspectors, take a look for a Wisconsin registered home inspector who is also an ASHI member, who is in the Fort Atkinson area. Call a couple of guys, ask them what they have for moisture meters for testing interstitial areas. Explain it to them. One of the guys is going to have the right meter, and he's going to come out and actually be able to give you some accurate measurements.
Marcy, thanks so much for that call. Let's go to Sandy in Delafield next. Hello, Sandy. Welcome to the Larry Mueller Show.
Thanks for taking my call. White mold in my closets. I had a wicker shelf in there, and I was cleaning it a few weeks ago, and I saw this little dusty, clumpy stuff on my leather purses and even on my shoes. And then I kind of looked through my clothing that was on the bottom pole, and that some of the dark stuff had a little, it looked like little spots of mold. And I have carpeting in there, and mm-hmm. I also thought I saw it in my other closet. I have two-bedroom condo. I do not have a basement, mm-hmm. and both of them have carpeting in the closets. What do you think?
It probably is mold. One of the things that we know, I mentioned we've got four different categories of building materials, but one thing that we know is things like leather shoes will get moldy long before building materials will. So The American Society of Heating, Refrigeration, Air Conditioning Engineers, ASHRAE, is really focused on building materials, not contents. But in all the articles, we know that contents often will get moldy before building materials will, because they have, you know, the organic compounds in them that are good food for mold. Now, what is probably happening is your closets are cooler than the rest of your house. So if the humidity in your house is 60 or 65%, the closets may go to 85%. Then at 85% or even 80% with leather, we are getting mold. So one possibility is to improve the insulation if that's possible in a condo. Sometimes it isn't. Some people use louvered closet doors so that the humidity and the temperature in the closet is similar to the inside of the house. If these are outside wall closets, you can take the drywall down, put up an inch of foam on the outside walls, put the drywall back up, and improve the temperature of that closet. So basically what we need to do is we need to lower the relative humidity in the closet by either increasing the temperature or increasing the airflow. Does that make sense?
I do. Do I just wash all the clothes and just, what do I do to the carpeting? I don't see
The clothes you can simply wash. The carpeting, yes, you're probably going to have a professional come in and clean the carpet. You know, just because there's carpet in the room doesn't mean there has to be carpet in the closet. Maybe you should just get rid of it and put a ceramic tile or a vinyl tile in the closet, something that is less likely to hold dirt. I mean, we have trouble cleaning our closets. It's hard to vacuum in there, isn't it? So we get all this accumulation of dust in the closets anyway. So maybe consider getting rid of the carpet in there and go to a floor that's easy to clean and is less likely to harbor.
And Sandy, you can toss the clothes and go shopping.
You go. Is there any way I'm going to get sick from this mold?
Possibly, yes. If it's got blue clumps, you're probably looking at a penicillin or an aspergillus. That generally does not affect most people unless they have asthma or a compromised immune system. But you should get it cleaned up. Now, basically, if you go to the EPA website, it's going to tell you that if it's more than something like 10 square feet, you really need to talk to a professional. So do a little bit of reading on this before you tackle this yourself. If you do tackle it yourself, you may want to go out and buy a respirator.
Hmm.
Go to a local construction safety place and say, I may be around some mold. I need a respirator with the right type of cartridge. And you're going to wear that when you move the clothes into the washing machine.
Be careful, Sandy. Thanks for the call, and good luck with those closets. By the way, Donna in Milwaukee called to suggest vinegar as an alternative to bleach. We're almost out of time, John Freiberger, and one of the things I wanted to be sure to get to is if we've got a serious mold problem in our house so that we would need a contractor, how do we make sure that we're getting somebody who knows what they're doing?
Oh, that's a good question. Most of them, fortunately, know what they're doing. Most of them have some sort of certification. You really need to check references with people. You need to go on Angie's List and check them out, though that certainly is not foolproof. Talk to people who have had serious issues, like somebody who's had a flood, a very broken water pipe. See who did a good job for them. There is a surprising lack of knowledge with some contractors, and others are extremely good. I've worked with a couple people here in Madison that have been absolutely wonderful. I've worked with one in Milwaukee that when he was done with the house, it was dirtier than when he started. So it is very difficult, but as we're always saying, when you've got to check references, check the contract. You also want to make sure you have an air test after somebody is done. You do not write a check until you get an air test by an independent person, which will cost you $400 or $500, to know that the cleanup was effective.
Yeah, because this is really serious stuff, and you really, really do not want to be messing around with this if you've got a major mold problem. This is probably not something you want to go into the DIY thing, right?
That is correct. And the other thing that we should mention, John, if we've just got a couple seconds here, is if this is due to a roof leak or something like that, you should have insurance coverage for this. If it's
right.
A one-time occurrence. If it's constant condensation or slow leak over years, you probably won't have coverage. But if you're going to spend a bunch of money, talk to your insurance company. Make
Absolutely.
Sure that maybe somebody else will pay for this.
All right, John Freiberger, thanks so much for being with us. You'll be back in December, according to the schedule, so people who maybe didn't get their question answered today can do it then. Thanks so much to Chris Molina and Michelle Good, Dave Potras, for helping to produce the Larry Mueller Show today. Larry out sick today. Hopefully he'll be back tomorrow when it will be time for Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show. Until then, John Munson, thanking you for joining me today. This is the Ideas Network of WPR.